Who was the first to paint the town red?
Why do we say you've screwed the pooch?
And how can you literally steal someone's thunder?
Don't flip your wig or eat your hat. It's idiom time on Words Unraveled. Welcome to another Words Unraveled. I'm Jess Zafaris, author of the etymology books Once Upon a Word and Words from Hell.
And I'm Rob Watts from the YouTube channel Rob Words. Read my lips as we take the bull by the horns and let the cat out of the bag in this exploration of the origins of all manner of English idioms on a new series of Words Unraveled. In fact, we've been away for a little bit. New season, as you would say.
We're back. I'm so excited to be back. We took a little bit of an extended break this time. We had some major life events happening. You got a really big Christmas present. Would you like to tell us a little about that?
Yes. Her name is Rosie, and she is a human person. My favorite little human person. Yes, born in December.
Oh, happy birthday, Rosie, and welcome to the world. I'm so excited to be your new podcast auntie.
Yeah, indeed. And in fact, her new podcast auntie was kind enough to send little Rosie a gift or two, one of which I'm going to show you.
Oh, lovely.
So here in Germany, you get regularly visited by a Hebamme, they call it, a midwife. That's the English word. They come and see you a few times afterwards. And they saw this little fellow here, which is a pink fox, for those who are listening, a fluffy pink fox. And the midwife asked me, what is the fluffy pink fox's name?
Ooh.
And I said, Jess.
Oh, no. No way.
Yeah. So say hello to Jess the fox. Oh. Little Rosie's new favorite toy, for sure.
Oh, that makes me so happy. Well, that's a lovely gift in and of itself. So thank you so much. I am so excited to see this little person grow in the world.
Yeah, me too. And thank you so much for sending this all the way from the United States as well. It's getting her off to a fine start. So personal stuff behind. Onto the idiom. Idioms. Actually, idiom is kind of a jargony phrase, I think. It's not, I don't think everyone necessarily knows what an idiom is. We talk about them quite sort of freely when we're into words and stuff. But what is an idiom?
We have a number of other phrases for idioms too, like a turn of phrase or an expression or something along those lines. It's a word that's a word or phrase that is metaphorical or winks and nods at its actual meaning.
The word idiom comes from the Latin idioma, which is something that is used by an individual or a small group, not necessarily a turn of phrase. It could be an object or a practice, but it goes back even further to the Greek idiotus, which gives us the word idiot as well. And that idios at the start means individual or private. So the original idiots, for example, were individual private people. And by private, you can read that as meaning unprofessional, non-professional. So that's how you get from the idea of someone being ignorant and therefore an idiot. It's because they are not trained in any sort of profession.
Excellent. Okay. That's great.
So can you kick us off with a juicy idiom that we can explore the origin?
Well, I will say, so I took recommendations for this. There are thousands and thousands of idioms. So we'll probably do another episode, but I wanted to get into some of the ones that people really wanted to know about that might have, say, misinformation about them. I have found in research for this podcast and in the past when I have written about idioms, that there is a desire to give these a firm origin, like a specific custom or occurrence that led to the use of the idiom. And there are some like that, but in many cases, these are just like general colloquialisms and have always been as metaphorical as they are now. So if you take anything away from this podcast, I would like it to be that idioms have always been and continue to be an exercise in creativity. And in many cases, they are not quite as satisfying as some of the explanations want them to be.
Go on then, disappoint us then, Jess.
All right.
Tell us about one of these.
For example, one of the more common idioms that you hear lots of different stories about, and it's probably because it appears in artistic settings, is break a leg, right? And this idiom is a way to wish performers good luck without saying the words good luck. And the logic behind it is that to be a player on the stage is to be superstitious and to not want to wish someone good luck in case you jinx them or in case you cause something unpleasant to happen to them by having bestowed a hope for good luck upon them. So instead, you say something unpleasant happens to them so that all the bad luck will be absorbed by your wish, perhaps. There are a lot of theories that are like stage curtains had legs, supposedly, and if a performer gave a great performance, they might break a leg or cause the curtains to move or collapse or something. Probably not true. Or I've seen people say that like people would stomp their feet in order to express their appreciation for the performance, and you might break your leg if you stomped your feet so hard. Also not true.
Yeah, that doesn't quite work either, because that's transferring the breaking of the leg to the audience, not to the actor.
Exactly. And really, it's unfortunately, it's just not that interesting. Like it is, but it comes down to like superstition. But this idiom wasn't extremely widespread until like the early 1900s in some contexts. It is found as early as the late 1800s. But for example, in the 1920s, Robert Wilson Lind wrote a piece for the New Statesman called A Defense of Superstition, where he explains the idiom, assuming that the audience won't have heard of it before.
Right.
Some widespread audiences wouldn't have heard of this, apparently.
Do we know why the idea of leg breaking is associated with good luck?
It is essentially like a reversal of expectations. It's instead of saying good luck, you should say something insulting like, may you break your leg.
Right, I see. Okay, so it's just trying to escape the bad juju of saying good luck.
There are several variations in other languages too. My favorite is the Italian in culo alla balena, which means in the whale's ass. And then you're supposed to reply, speriamo che non caghi, which means let's hope it doesn't. I don't know how widespread that one is. Someone who speaks Italian is going to have to tell me how frequently people wish that upon others, but I like it.
I think we have a new thing to say before we start recording. Oh, that's grim. Something that's going to be a theme, I suspect, through this episode is the theater. Because a lot of idioms do come from either from plays or the practices of the theatre. And they've come from plays because plays have down the centuries been a good opportunity for shared experience and for references that a lot of people can get, be you literate or not. You can go along and you can see a certain thing occur that forms a good metaphor that can be used at a later date. One such idiom that comes from the theatre is to steal someone's thunder.
Thunderous applause?
Well, no. So that is a very, very good guess. The idea that, he stole the show. He took my thunder, my thunderous applause. It's actually both more literal and less literal than you might think. So it doesn't refer to, I don't know, someone stealing the bombast or the showiness from someone. But what it is a very specific story. And this story has been told in so many different good sources down the centuries that I tend to believe it, and all the reference books do believe it. And it relates to a playwright and critic called John Dennis, who produced a play back in 1709 called Appius and Virginia. And it was a flop.
Oh, no.
But what was interesting about this play was that he deployed a completely new system to make a certain sound effect. And that was to create a more realistic thunder sound.
Oh.
Now, yeah. And while John Dennis was still feeling rather sore about the failure of his play, he went to watch another play. It was a performance of Macbeth, an old classic, of course, by Shakespeare. And he noticed during it that they were using his system to create the thunder sound effect. So he is said to have exclaimed on realizing this, "Damn them, they will not let my play run, but they will steal my thunder."
Ah, no kidding. That's so cool.
Yeah. And it's one of those ones that it sounds too good to be true, but it is referenced in so many. I mean, the precise words that he used vary between the sources, but over the couple of centuries after 1709, you see this being referenced in lots of books about playwrights and English literature. It only becomes really an idiom in the 1900s, there or thereabouts, when enough people have sort of come to be aware of it and it's become a reference. But that story has been kept alive all that time in the meantime. And yeah, to steal someone's thunder is actually to steal their idea.
I love that. And it is the ones that have like a very specific literary or theatrical reference that stick around and do have like a clearer connection to their first source material. Like Cool as a Cucumber too is from a poem by John Gay. He described himself as cool. Well, he didn't describe himself as cool as a cucumber, but he said he would be as cool as a cucumber if a lady had returned his advances. And it's in the poem it's in is called New Song on New Similes. And so it's full of these elaborate similes, like my passion is as mustard strong or drunk as a piper all day long. And then also things like cool as a cucumber.
I see. I do like Cool as a Cucumber,
Me
by
too.
The way. I use
and,
that
And
one.
It's true. Like cucumbers are about 20% cooler than their environment because of their water content.
No, wait, is that true?
Yeah.
Is that true? Uh-huh. I think of them as very refreshing, nevertheless. So that was Steal One's Thunder. And what I like about that one is there is really sort of only one explanation for that one. But as you already explained, a lot of the time you can get multiple explanations because people are just looking for the best possible yarn out of it. And also people like to take ownership of the stories, particularly areas like to say that this thing happened where we are. For example, the town of Melton Mowbray, which is in Leicestershire, I think, in England, very famous for its pork pies, but it also is trying to be famous for the term to paint the town red. It claims that the idiom to paint the town red comes from a particularly raucous night out when a man called the Marquis of Waterford had been to the races with his pals. They'd had a drunken day at the races. And on their way home, they'd come across a toll booth where the toll keeper had been less than cooperative with them. So what they did was they boarded him in his toll booth and they stole his red paint. They daubed it all over his toll booth and then continued into the town where they rampaged with this tin. I don't know, it would have been a tin. What year are we talking? 1837? I don't know. They got this paint. They daubed it all over the town. And lo was the term to paint the town red born to refer to a debauched night out.
Oh my.
Yeah. But it's not where it comes from.
There it is.
it just isn't. I mean, the term isn't, that story doesn't emerge until a good 50 years after the Marquis is dead. Mm-hmm. And also it's actually an American idiom originally. The precise source isn't known, but it's likely to refer to the idea of setting fire to things and the glow of the flames lighting up the surrounding buildings.
I see.
Red. Yeah. But there is one other good theory, literary theory. The problem is I really struggled whilst researching this to get to the bottom of whether any of it is true. But what you will see if you look this up is a lot of people saying, oh, Oscar Wilde says that this term comes from Dante. And now Oscar Wilde is one of those people who, more than just about anyone, probably him and Winston Churchill, has quotes attributed to him falsely. So you have to take this one with a pinch of salt.
Uh-huh.
But supposedly, the deal with the Oscar Wilde quote is that there's an extract in Dante's Inferno that includes the phrase, "We are they who painted the world scarlet with sins."
Ah, okay.
Yeah, so painting it scarlet with
so
sins.
So like blood colored.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And actually Wilde does use in The Canterville Ghost, so one of his spooky stories, he does talk about all our spry young fellows painting the old world red. So it could well be that he is making a reference to Dante and the Inferno with that turn of phrase of his own.
I think that's reasonable.
Yeah, I think so. And it is something of a coincidence, isn't it, that they're talking about painting the world scarlet rather than painting the town red. But yeah, I just couldn't get to the bottom of whether Oscar Wilde actually said that or whether that phrases even in Dante's Inferno, because it wasn't in any of the ones that I looked at, but it might just be that it was an unusual translation of it or Oscar Wilde's own translation of it, and therefore it wouldn't be verbatim the same, so my search wouldn't have come up with it, because I did not read through the entirety of Dante's Inferno for the sake of this podcast.
Really? Slacker.
Not this time. Maybe the next time we get around to doing an idioms episode, because I'm sure we will have to do more of them, I will have done. But yeah, Paint the Town Red's actually an American idiom from the 1800s, probably.
A lot of the idioms that we use now are from like the 1800s and onward, simply because I believe like they tend to be more colloquial and slang changes frequently. So the cliches we use change over time. There are some that are quite a bit older. Beat around the bush is a very old idiom, for example. This one is pretty obvious. If you were hunting birds, you would beat a bush to make the birds come up and fly out of the bush so that you can shoot them. And specifically, you would have people whose responsibility was to beat the bush and scare the birds, whereas the person doing the shooting would be directly killing the birds, and you're being a little indirect by being the one to hit the bush. The first written record of this is in a 15th century Middle English poem that says, "Some beta the bush and some the bird is take," which means like some people are the ones beating the bush and some are the ones who are grabbing the birds. That's reflected in several other poems and verses throughout history. But I do think it's interesting that like the first implication in these contexts is that like some people's role is to do the bush beating while other people get to benefit from that person's work, which has a slightly different connotation than like simply indirectly provoking an action, which I didn't find until the 1700s. There's a record of a religious official speaking poorly of an opposing religious sect in front of a young man in order to motivate him to convert. So the manuscript calls this beating around the bush. Rather than telling the young man to convert, you verbally attack the opposing belief system to steer him in the right moral or religious direction.
Yeah, I suppose to beat around the bush would be to disturb everything but the area that you kind of want to disturb.
Right. Or to indirectly provoke an action by talking or beating around it, so to speak.
Whilst we're talking about beating, can I talk about biting?
Yeah,
because
let's do it.
There's another really old idiom or set of idioms that we can talk about. And I found this while looking up bite the dust. You have the term bite the dust. It's kind of obvious, I suppose, what it means, but it's when you're kind of you're mortally wounded and you're lying on the ground and you're sort of chewing at the dust on the ground. But what I thought was interesting when I was researching this is that there's a whole array of variations on that go back as far as Old English. So, you know, the best part of a thousand years or more. And they're variations like to bite the grass, to bite the earth, to bite the sand, to bite the soil, you know, to bite the ground. The earliest one actually was from early Middle English. So maybe I was exaggerating when I said Old English, but early Middle English. So that's the 12th century. So you're getting still good 900 years old. And yeah, it's in a description of a battle in which 16,000 people died. It says, "Mani mutha the gres bort," which means many mouths bit the grass, which I think is really sort of dark sounding, isn't it? You can imagine this battlefield strewn with dead bodies face down, biting the grass. Really grim. And then in the 16th century, there's a translation of the Aeneid, which has bitten the erd, which means, you know, bitten the earth. But I don't know if you found yourself going down rabbit holes from one idiom to another, because that's actually how I got to the bite the dust one, because I started at bite the bullet, because I think people perhaps do know where that one came from, but
yeah, I would think that most people would know the origin of that one because it's fairly literal, right?
Yeah, it goes back to a time when there was no anesthesia. So an injured soldier, for example, would be given something hard to bite down on as they were put in excruciating pain. And often that would be a bullet, because that's the sort of thing that a soldier might have to hand. So to bite the bullet is to not only brace yourself, but to prepare to do something very painful, be it figuratively or literal.
It would also, my understanding, and I am speculating here, but lead, the lead from which bullets were made, was softer than biting on other things, so your teeth would have somewhere to go.
Oh yeah, you want a bit of give, right?
Yeah, right. Of course, I'm sure that there was additional damage from chewing on lead, so.
The earliest example of it was in, this is according to the OED, so the Oxford English Dictionary. It has a quote from Francis Gross, who is a friend of the podcast,
let's say.
The writer of the classical dictionary of the vulgar tongue. He spent a load of time in ale houses and such around London, marking down the strange phrases that the local people used. And in that, he says, it is a point of honor in some regiments never to cry out while under the discipline of the cat of nine tails. So he's talking about the whip there, actually, to avoid which, he says, they chew on a bullet. So that's the earliest reference that the OED has to the idea of chewing on a bullet to withstand the pain. And then Rudyard Kipling's using it in 1891 in The Lights That Failed. He says, bite on the bullet, old man, and don't let them think you're afraid.
I've also seen the cat of nine tails incorrectly affiliated with other idioms. Like, people really want that to be the explanation for anything regarding cats, but it's usually cats. Like, that's usually the explanation, is actual cats.
Is it all the cat ones? So it's let the cat out of the bag, for example, which is an idiom that actually relates to another idiom, which is a pig in a poke, you know, to buy a pig in a poke. It's the idea of buying, for example, a pig in a bag and then opening it when you get home and realizing it's not what you expected it to be. It's not the quality of pig you want, or indeed it is a cat. And so the revelation, the letting of the cat out of the bag, is the moment of realization, or the moment of declaring or making it clear that something's gone wrong.
Right. For much of history, cats weren't like considered necessarily the most cuddly of pets. Sometimes like plagues were blamed on them and they were more pests than friends. So, grabbing a cat for meat and trying to pass it off as pork or something would be selling someone inferior meat, and you let the cat out of the bag and you reveal that it is not, in fact, a pig. That one's actually pretty straightforward. And I was pleased to find that it does have evidence for the more literal and story-friendly interpretation. The other one that I have seen in affiliation with the cat of nine tails is cat got your tongue, the idea being that you were whipped so soundly that you can't talk anymore. But that's also not, there's no evidence to support it. The more likely theory is simply like, your tongue's a wiggly thing that when cats like to go after wiggly things. So it's like a cute thing you would say to a kid, sort of like, got your nose, did the cat get your tongue?
And a nice bridge we can do here is from biting to cat having your tongue is that we also have to bite your tongue, which is literal. It's the idea of biting down on your tongue so that you can't speak, but it goes back a long way as well. You can have to bite your lip as well, which is to bite on your lip so that you, what ways to bite your lip? So you don't say anything stupid, is it?
It's the same thing as bite your tongue for the most part. I mean, you can also like bite your lip in a number of other ways. There's like the like sexy biting your lip, and then there's like the hesitation and the like delaying or thinking about something, biting your lip, but that's not quite the same as biting your tongue.
I found in a really early usage of bite one's lip actually from the 12th century, from around 1380, and it's Charlie's bot is lippen though, for he had nocht his will.
I like it.
I don't really know what it means.
Really, I should revise my earlier statement when I said like a lot of idioms are from the past 200 years. It's less that than that they had earlier variations or there were differently phrased.
I think it's fair to say that. I just think we're picking the ones that are older because they're just a bit more interesting. They've got more of a story to them. That's very us.
A couple that are relatively recent but have loads of myths about them are Dead Ringer and Saved by the Bell. These are both often said to be like you would bury someone alive and someone would have to sit by the bell that was extended down into your grave to wait for you to come alive so they can dig you out if you were accidentally buried alive. And while people were like probably accidentally buried alive a few times, there's not a lot of evidence that like Saved by the Bell has any affiliation with this, or that a dead ringer was someone who would ring said bell or wait for the bell to be rung, which is the claim. Rather, these are from ones from horse racing. A ringer was a fraudulent horse submitted for another in a race. And then dead means like spot on, sort of like it's a dead giveaway or...
it's like a good one for one swap.
Exactly. So a dead ringer is a horse that was swapped and looks very similar. And then the Saved by the Bell myth is probably from boxing.
Oh, like, yeah. Yeah, okay. You're about to be knocked out. Luckily, the bell's gone off.
Right.
Saved by the Bell. Ding, ding.
You don't have to like tap out. You can be, or you won't get counted out. You're saved by the end of the round.
For whom the bell tolls and death knell, they really do relate to...
Oh, those are very much affiliated with dead people.
Yeah, but they're the bells that are rung on the death of someone rather than the little... I mean, I don't even know if that bell thing extended down into the ground is real. You know, the idea of having a bell that the dead person themselves can ring if it just so happens they've been buried alive.
Don't get buried alive, but...
get
but
cremated.
Like the bell contraption... We don't have a lot of evidence for.
Okay. Okay.
It may have happened once or twice, but.
What about drunkenness idioms? Can I steer us in that direction?
Ooh, let's do it. Let's get a little sloshed.
Well, because I was talking about how places like to claim ownership of certain idioms, and one that pubs all over the country in Britain, I don't know if they do in the United States as well, they might well do, like to claim is the phrase on the wagon. I know there's a pub in my hometown of Derby that claims to be the source of on the wagon because it's right next to the old jail. It supposedly harks back to a time when a condemned man on his way to the gallows or the chopping block would be allowed to have one single drink before they were taken away to their demise. And the pub would be the place where they could have that last drink. And then they would be put on the wagon to never drink again because they were off to their death. But it doesn't come from any pub. It's actually, again, really an American idiom. And it originally comes from on the water wagon. A water wagon was a wagon that would go around spraying water on the ground to keep sort of the dust from lifting. You know, if you keep it damp, then you don't get dust everywhere. So on the water wagon was the original phrase commonly used in the United States, but not really known in Britain. So that's perhaps why in Britain we felt the need to come up with our own explanation for where it comes from. But presumably someone who is on the water wagon would eschew an alcoholic drink in favor of the water that they've got ready access to.
I didn't know that one. That's great.
It's nice. But that's the second one we've come up with that has turned out to be an American idiom that Brits are claiming ownership of. We've got to watch out for that. We do that, don't we? We do that.
We exchange phrases. I mean, you know, most of the language that we speak is from your side of the pond, so.
Well, English. Yeah,
yeah, right.
Yeah.
You can have a couple idioms.
Thank you. So magnanimous. Sober as a judge, another drunkenness-related or sobriety-related idiom. It's not actually known whether that is supposed to be ironic or legit, and you can find quotations in both directions. Is it that judges are particularly sober, or is it that judges were famously unsober?
I am unfamiliar with any judges who are well known for being overly inebriated. I always assumed that one was pretty literal. Like,
well, so, okay, I found a quote. I say I found a quote. These are listed in the OED description of this thing. So they found the quotes, and now I am reading them to you. But from 1734... there is a quotation from Henry Fielding's Don Quixote in England, which is a comedy. It has Sir Thomas Loveland saying, "Dear Squire, let me entreat you. Would you go to bed? You are a little heated with wine." And then the squire, whose name is Badger for some reason, says, "Oons, sir, do you say that I am drunk? I say, sir, that I am as sober as a judge. And if any man says that I am drunk, sir, he's a liar and a son of a whore." So really escalates. But
yeah, it's hard to tell whether he's being ironic or not.
It is
that.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. And to all accounts he is drunk. Mm-hmm. Right,
so it's probably irony.
Yeah, well, you can't be sure. He might genuinely just be protesting. But then there's another quote from 1834 where someone says, "I was as sober as a judge," observed Tom. "Maybe, Tom, as a judge after dinner." Yes. So that's someone saying, yeah. So judges in their downtime tend to be inebriated more often than the average man because they can afford to be.
I mean, I could see that. That sounds like a stressful job. So,
yeah. And so we also have the phrase drunk as a lord. I don't know if you have that in the States, but that genuinely is from the idea that lords are so wealthy and so sort of idle that they've got plenty of time to get drunk.
I feel like in my experience, we have the more appellation drunk as a skunk, and that's mostly just because it rhymes. Like
it's very satisfying, though. I like a good drunk as a skunk. More likely to use it than drunk as a lord.
That one sounds a little dated.
It does. In fact, it goes back at least as far as the 17th century.
One that I think is pretty interesting and has a lot of history behind it, although like its actual usage and the way we phrase it now is relatively recent, is raining cats and dogs. I guess we've done a lot of cat and dog ones, but this is like, people really want this one to have certain origins, and its real one is actually a bit more disgusting than...
So can I tell you what I read about this one?
Yeah,
did not believe. I didn't go any deeper into it. Okay. I just had a cursory look, and the explanation that was given was that there was a time when the rain would just happen to wash stray cats and dogs into the street.
Yeah, that's right. It's corpses specifically.
Is that
the
truth?
So this is the thing. Yeah, it's much worse.
Dead cats and dogs.
Yeah, dead cats and dogs. Like during a time when public sanitation was less of a thing, all kinds of things would end up in the gutter, including like the corpses of dogs and cats. And one of the things that like there are references to like dead cats and dogs being washed down the street as early as the 16th century. Jonathan Swift also notes this sort of thing in a popular poem from 1710. This poem is called a Description of a City Shower, and it describes a deluge washing all sorts of grossness and an assortment of things, including dead animals. He doesn't say raining cats and dogs, but he says sweepings from butchers' stalls, dung, guts, and blood, drowned puppies, stinking sprats, all drenched in mud, dead cats and turnip tops come tumbling down the flood. And it seems that, like, although the concept of dead animals being washed down the street is earlier than Swift, we have evidence as early as like the 1610s, but he was very popular at the time in writing poems that people would quote frequently. The other claim you get is that dogs and cats would like crawl up into the thatching on your roof and fall out when it rained. But there's just that just didn't happen that often. Like your dog had a hard time getting into the thatching on your roof. And, maybe a mouse would fall out or something, but less cats and dogs. And it probably is more that like disgusting dead gutter situation, unfortunately.
I prefer, I think, with this one, Jess, to stick with the image that has always been in my head of cats and dogs falling to the ground. The problem is, I think the cats could survive the fall. I worry for the dogs.
Yeah, I have dogs and a cat, and the cat's not as graceful as most cats, but he'd be more likely to land on his feet.
For sure.
I have another one that will that's on the...
You've got another one that's going to upset me.
It's not disgusting, but it's definitely on the raunchier side.
Of course you have. I'm amazed we haven't got... I mean, okay, so we've literally gone into the gutter already, or well, figuratively, literally.
This one is by request, so... And two people requested it, so I have to do it.
No, I'm not having this. You can choose which ones you approach. Don't blame it on other people. Go on, then. What have you got?
All right, it's Screwed the Pooch.
Oh, God. Please, no, Jet, no.
We have to. People asked.
This is, sorry, I've got to say, before we came on today, I did have to send Jess a quick message to check on an idiom that I came across, which was to pull a boner. In the dictionary I looked in, it said it was an American turn of phrase. I'm sorry, I'm not having pull a boner. What does it mean?
I have a joke book from the 1920s called Boners. Like it's called like Boners, Gags, and Jokes. And a boner was a joke. And I think in that context, it may be affiliated with like funny bones. But in other like pulling a boner, that phrase as a word for what you're thinking of is also not like it's relatively old. So we, you know. It's not associated with that.
All right, but let's get away from pulling boners and back onto screwing pooches.
No, this one's worse.
Where does it come from?
So the most credible theory is that it is a minced version of a more vulgar phrase, and that is f*** the dog. And that one dates back to at least the 1930s, but is probably like maybe even older, both originally appeared in military slang and both are first recorded with that more vulgar variation. And the first meaning of the dog, by the way, is to loaf around or kill time.
Stop saying it.
Okay. I'll stop saying that. Anyway.
It just comes off the tongue so easily, Jess. Oh, yeah. I really worry.
I desensitized myself with these books. But the original meaning of the more vulgar version of this phrase was like loafing around or being lazy. And that's kind of the same idea with of like, you also get idioms around like masturbating as a word for like killing time. And then by the 1960s, it took on the sense of like making a blunder. So like you're so inebriated, perhaps, that you have sex with the dog instead of your spouse or something like that. sorry.
You're not sorry.
But the reason screwed the pooch entered popular discourse is probably, so it's in like aviator slang. And then Tom Wolfe wrote this fabulous book you may have read called The Right Stuff, which is about the swaggering bravado of test pilots in the American space program who came from military aviation. And it's thought to have contributed to the popularity of Screwed the Pooch, because in the book, he literally explains that slang element that they use as being an alternative to like something up.
What I don't understand is why you would choose a minced oath for effed the dog that carries exactly the same meaning.
Well, one of them has at the time was more R-rated language, but I feel like they're both equally vulgar.
Sure,
now.
I want to talk about sexual intercourse with a canine, but I don't want to swear.
What? Would you like to clean us up with a more G-rated?
Not in a month of Sundays would I like to. Actually, we could go into that one, actually.
Yeah,
quite a brief one. It's kind of obvious. It's the idea that Sundays are really boring because of religious restrictions. You know, no shops
are
open.
So you can't go to the bar or whatever. Mm-hmm.
You're not supposed to work. You're not supposed to do all sorts of things. So they can really drag. So a month of Sundays would be very long. But there is another potential, not source for it, but this is a quote that gives a different impression, a slightly different impression of what it means. It's kind of similar, but a little bit different. It's from 1849. It's a guy called G. E. Jewsbury. He talked in reference to this, the absence of there being any postal deliveries on a Sunday. And he said to his correspondent, "If I don't get a better letter from you, you may pass a month of Sundays at breakfast without any letter from me." So the idea, it not happening on a Sunday. So it'll never happen. You'll never get that letter because there's no post on a Sunday.
Is it still common for like drinking establishments to be closed on Sundays?
No.
Okay, I wouldn't think so. That feels like a...
Here in Germany, all shops are closed on a Sunday.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Like here in Berlin, I will often have to find a railway station because there's an exemption for supermarkets that are at railway stations on a Sunday if I desperately need some bread or some milk or something on a Sunday. So it's a big thing here. Back in Britain, Sunday trading is a thing, but you can trade on a Sunday. But for example, supermarkets are limited. I think they can only open for like 6 hours on a Sunday. So a Sunday is fundamentally more boring than any other day of the week, nevertheless. So yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Over in corporate hell, the only day you can do your shopping is on Sunday. So.
Ah, right. Okay. Yeah.
We all work too hard on this side of the pond to take our Saturdays off. Or we just have to recover from the week on Saturday and then on Sunday you can go to Costco or whatever.
I mean, I would prefer it, really. I know the reasons that it's upheld here are not particularly religious. It's more about giving people a day's rest.
I mean, I like that.
Endorsed by the government, which is no bad thing, but it's inconvenient.
Right. You
know? But we have quite a lot of different terms for something that's never going to happen, for example, or is rarely going to happen, like once in a blue moon. So there are a couple of theories behind that one. So the idea of a blue moon, so a blue moon is when there are two new moons, two full moons within a calendar month. So that only happens once or twice a year because you've got 12 calendar months, but 13 lunar months in a year. So sometimes you will get a blue moon. So that makes it a sort of rare occurrence. But there's also a theory that an older origin of it is that once in a blue moon, the blue is kind of arbitrary, but it's the idea that the moon is never blue. So if it's going to happen in a blue moon, it's never going to happen.
Ah, interesting.
When pigs fly as well, there's another one. Mm. It'll happen when pigs fly. The original idiom was not when pigs fly. It was when pigs fly in the air with their tails forward.
What?
So it was something even more, yeah, unusual.
Ooh.
Was considered. Yeah, from 1581, there's a quote, "This is a great promise, my good lord, but when will this be done? When pigs fly with their tails forward."
No kidding.
Yeah, that was far more common. You just look, you see loads of usages of it like that.
And extra degree of absurdity, I suppose.
Yeah. But funnily enough, like the king of the absurd, Lewis Carroll, is one of the first people on record as using the shorter version, just the "when pigs fly" in Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. "I've a right to think," said Alice sharply. "Just about as much right," said the Duchess, "as pigs have to fly."
Ah, very nice.
So sass from the Duchess to mm-hmm. Alice there.
That'll do. Yeah. Another one that has... it is longer originally and has had its meaning lost a little bit over time, is "by the skin of your teeth."
Oh, so where does that come from? Because your teeth don't have skin.
Right. This is, well, they do. And we'll get into where that skin is. This is from the Book of Job. And in the particularly like the King James Version has one more logical version of this, and then the Geneva Bible has a different variation on it. So the King James Version is, "My bone cleaveth to my skin and to my flesh, and I am escaped with the skin of my teeth." And by that he means his gums. Like, I'm so skinny, I don't have any flesh, not in the epidermis sense, but in the like meat and bones sense, except for the gums on my teeth. That's like the last flesh on my body. In the Geneva Bible, it's translated as, "I have escaped with the skin of my teeth," more simply.
"With the skin of my teeth" makes far more sense than "by the skin of my teeth."
Yeah, and it may be the Geneva Bible perhaps confused the meaning over time into this idiom. There was a play in the 1940s that may have helped like cement this as like a narrow escape, especially in like adventure-y senses. There was a play called "The Skin of Our Teeth" by Thornton Wilder. That's a comedy drama that depicts biblically inspired modern characters surviving dangerous situations by dumb luck. He may not have been the first person to use it in that way, but I my understanding is that helped a bit.
Okay, but now I've got this very vivid image that it does make a lot more sense to me.
Right. It's much less disturbing than, maybe not much less disturbing because starvation is also terrible, but I feel like skin on teeth is creepier.
Do you have the phrase "to read the Riot Act" in the States?
Yeah, absolutely. But I actually don't know what the Riot Act is.
Well, it's an actual act of law. It's an act of British law that was introduced just in the wake of the Jacobite Rebellion. And the aim of it was to prevent further civil unrest.
Right, that makes sense.
The act provided that groups of 12 men or more, if instructed to disperse and read a section of that act, had to do so, otherwise they were committing a felony. So to read someone the Riot Act was to, yeah, was to tell them to...
stop that or else.
Yeah, exactly. Stop that or else. Very good. I like the fact that it is a literal act. And it's an act that wasn't repealed in England and Wales until the 1960s, 1967.
It's so specific too. I like it.
Nowadays, I just tend to hear it in sort of footballing contexts when a manager will read the Riot Act to his players, perhaps at halftime, and they'll come out with a bit more spirit in them. Oh, here's another funny British one that I only really hear in sporting contexts. But have you ever heard of "to be sick as a parrot"?
I have heard this, but it doesn't come up very often in my life.
I mean, I've only heard it in footballing context and not recently. I think there was a fashion for describing, a team that had lost, or a player that had missed in a catastrophic way, or a manager who was irritated as being sick as a parrot. And you think, well, what's so sick about parrots? But it supposedly goes back to another play way, way back, actually 1682, a play called "The False Count" by Aphra Behn, in which one of the characters called Jacinta says to her mistress, "Lord, madam, you are as melancholy as a sick parrot."
Interesting. As melancholy as a sick parrot.
Yeah. So I why this would be so popular among football pundits, I don't know. But I'm not surprised to hear that they've kind of twisted it a little bit.
I hear "sick as a dog." The explanation is actually quite sad. It's just that dogs lived outside in poor conditions and therefore often had things like mange and the plague and things like that. So carriers of illness in some contexts dating back to like the early 1700s, which poor dogs.
We're no closer to knowing why a parrot would be considered something to, as a sick parrot would be a point of reference. But I'm not satisfied with any of this because if you're sick as a sick thing, then you're sick, right? I'm sick as a sick beetle. I'm sick as a sick magpie.
Yeah, were dogs really that associated with illness? Were parrots really that associated with illness? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't know. When you say more investigation required, I think. Have you got any more for us, Jess?
I had a couple people request a couple on headgear, like eating your hat and flipping your wig. These are fairly literal. Like they're not like that exciting, but some of the history behind them is a bit fun. This one, I'd eat my hat, has an earlier version that dates back to King Charles II of England. The phrase was, I'll eat old Rowley's hat. Evidently, old Rowley was a nickname for King Charles II, and It came from a stallion racehorse that belonged to the king and was known for its beauty and the number of its offspring. And the king was also known for having many mistresses and illegitimate children, much like the horse. So I don't know fully whether that's true. So let's do a fact check on that one at some point. But either way, that was indeed a nickname for him. But I'd eat my hat. It is from a similar era. And it's about like you'd expect. Like it's if something were true, then I would do something absurd like chewing on my hat. It does have a little bit of a different connotation in or just implies strong emphasis in Charles Dickens' Pickwick Papers. If I knew as little of life as that, I'd eat my hat and swallow the buckle whole. Mr. Pickwick is being called excessively ignorant, which is a bit of a different connotation than the other formation of I'd eat my hat. But he probably popularized that usage of it at the very least.
Yeah.
Now flip your wig. We've talked about a couple of other wig idioms in other episodes. Like we talked on a previous episode about the idea of wigging out. There are several terms like this, including dash my wig as an exclamation.
I love dash my wig.
Wigs on the green as an idiom for a public fight or like a big rumble on the green. And it's the same idea here. You're so mad that you're either moving your head vehemently to dislodge your wig or you're pulling it off to throw it on the ground and fight. But flip your wig is relatively recent. It's probably that phrasing particular and then flip out are probably both like 1940s or later. I found a mention of it in a novel from that era, like early 1900s to mid 1900s. Graham nearly flipped her wig. And here, of course, we have less the like fashionable wig and more the when you're experiencing hair loss kind of wig. That expression is also related to like flipping your lid, also a word for hat.
And to pull the wool over someone's eyes is to pull their wig over their face to try and obscure their view.
Less sheep-oriented than you would think.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, before I researched this, I just imagined someone with yeah, like a sheep's fleece over their face. So I was just coming up behind someone and yeah, assaulting them with part of a sheep. Jess, I think I'm losing steam here. Perhaps it is time to hit the road or make tracks. I've enjoyed this a lot, though.
This has been so much fun. I am sure that we will revisit idioms in the future. There are, as we have said, thousands of them, and there's a great deal more to explore. But next time, we'll be on a different topic. We'll see what we discuss, and we're excited to be back on Words Unraveled.
And it won't be in another month of Sundays that we catch you next. Goodbye.